Marty Moscowen, welcome to Radio Times. The recent execution of Troy Davis in Georgia has reignited the debate over the death penalty, which is legal in 35 states. Davis was convicted of killing a police officer and maintained his innocence until his execution last month. A new Gallup poll found that while a majority of people favor capital punishment, that support has eroded over time. Pennsylvania has the death penalty and has used it three times since it was reinstated in 1976. We wanted to get several perspectives on the death penalty and asked David Garland to get us started in this hour of Radio Times. He's a professor of law and a professor of sociology at New York University. He's also the author of a book called Peculiar Institution, America's Death Penalty in an Age of Abolition. And David Garland, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm interested in the title of your book, Peculiar Institution. How so?
So the American death penalty is peculiar in a number of ways. First of all, as a comparative matter, it's the only nation that has the death penalty. The USA is the only nation that has the death penalty in the Western world these days. So we look kind of peculiar by comparison. And that's especially odd that we still have it now, since 100 years ago, America was one of the first nations to be giving up the death penalty, so our status today is odd. The second peculiarity of the death penalty today in America is the very odd way in which it's applied and operationalized. We have about 14,000 or 15,000 homicides every year in this country. We sentence to death about 110 individuals, so that's a very small number of these. And of the very few people who are sentenced to death, only about a third or a half of them are ever executed, and typically after about 20 years. So that's a very peculiar arrangement, doesn't seem very well suited to the usual crime control objectives. And finally, American listeners will know, peculiar institution refers to the institution of slavery. And there's clearly a continuing thematic connection between capital punishment today and slavery and Jim Crow and lynching in the southern states in the historic past. So these are the connotations of the title of the book.
In fact, it was photos of lynchings that got you thinking about the death penalty in the U.S.
That's right. One of the striking things about modern America, even 20th century America, is the extent to which these violent mob crimes still existed and were basically permitted and colluded in by local enforcement agents, sheriffs and law enforcement agents in southern counties permitted these lynchings to take place. And what struck me at the time was two things about this. One was that the popular control of criminal justice is one of the distinctive things about America, and maybe explains some of the continuation of capital punishment here long after it disappeared elsewhere. And the other thing is that the places where these lynchings were occurring, in southern states primarily, focused on black perpetrators of crimes against white victims, they're the same kinds of patterns and the same kind of places where the death penalty is used today.
But these lynchings took place in public. Executions take place largely in private.
Well, look, it's a very different arrangement. Nobody can say that the form of today's capital punishment looks like a lynching. After all, there are no lynchings that take 14 or 15 years on average to carry out. The individuals who are sentenced to death today typically have about 9 rounds of judicial hearings and habeas corpus appeals and so on. Troy Davis, who you mentioned in the introduction, he was put to death about 20 years after having been convicted, and in the process there were many, many stages of judicial review of his case. This looks nothing like a lynching in its form. On the other hand, the social dynamics and situations look very similar. Troy Davis is a black defendant accused of killing a white law enforcement officer, and the death sentence is imposed by basically an outraged jury representing community opinion. It's not so very different in that respect.
It is a state's rights issue in many ways. I mean, there are 35 states that have the death penalty, meaning that there are 15 that don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the USA is really not one place for these purposes. I mean, I mentioned a moment ago that many of the states in the USA, particularly the northern and northeastern states, abolished the death penalty long before the European countries did. So Michigan, for example, gave it up in 1846, Rhode Island, Wisconsin, about the same time. And there have been about half the states, 25 of the states, that at one time or other have abolished the death penalty, and then about 9 of them have reimposed it. So that currently you have 16 states that don't have the death penalty. And that what that tells you is that this is a story of local state decision-making. In fact, if you look at where the death penalty is carried out, it's really a county-by-county variation, because different prosecutors responding to local public opinion either do or don't indict death penalty cases as such.
Well, I'm thinking of Texas, which of course has carried out the death penalty, even compared to Pennsylvania, which does have the death penalty, and it has been carried out 3 times since it was reinstated in 1976, more than 25 years ago.
Well, you know, even amongst the states that still have the death penalty, and actually only 34 of them have it these days, because New York had it on the books and it's been voided, amongst these states, many of them, Pennsylvania included, have the death penalty on the books, sentence some people to death, but rarely carry out these sentences. About a dozen states are in that position, that they really have the death penalty mostly in name, and over the last 40 years have executed 1 or 2, or in Pennsylvania's case, 3 individuals. So that these are states with the death penalty but are not really execution states. In contrast, somewhere like Texas or Florida or Oklahoma, typically states in the South, utilize the death penalty on a more frequent basis. But even in Texas, the death penalty remains relatively rare compared to all the homicides and all the murder cases.
You have compared the United States and Europe, and of course, in some ways it is apples and oranges, but I also read, and frankly I had no idea, that back in the 1970s, France still had the guillotine.
France was guillotining people in 1977.
In 1977.
It's a remarkable fact that the French only abolished the death penalty in 1981, and many other countries in Europe, Spain and Portugal, 1970s, Britain in the 1960s. So abolition in the rest of the Western world is really relatively recent. And one of the things that's worth bearing in mind is that these decisions to abolish the death penalty were always taken by national governments, despite the fact that a majority of the population still supported the death penalty. This is a case where, you know, considerations of human rights or considerations of appropriate punishments were taken by national elites despite popular support.
Is that true today, that in Europe there is popular support for the death penalty?
Well, as measured by polls, yes. And then, of course, it depends when the poll gets taken. There are some countries that are still fervently in favor of the death penalty. For example, Poland recently acceded to the EU, joined the European Union. In order to do so, joining the Council of Europe first, it had to give up its death penalty. The death penalty is still very popular in Poland. It's very popular in Britain, too, especially if the opinion poll's taken a few days after a very serious crime has occurred. But by and large, the opinion doesn't go very deep and doesn't change people's voting behavior. And typically, when, for example, François Mitterrand, president of France, gets elected in 1981, decides to abolish the death penalty despite 73% of French public opinion being in favor of it, he doesn't have to face an election for another 5 years. And when he does, Frenchmen are going to be voting on the basis of economic issues and employment issues and so on. So the death penalty can be abolished without much in the way of accountability or punishment for these parties. In this country, with elections every 2 years, with primaries, with very little in the way of kind of strong party discipline on both sides, it's much more difficult for local officials and elected officials to do what was done in Europe.
Do you think the use of DNA evidence is changing public opinion on the death penalty? And while there is still majority support, it isn't the majority that it was, let's say, 20 years ago.
I do think that the concerns about innocence are one of the big considerations that have shifted public opinion. By the way, of all the innocence cases on death row, there have been about 139 people released from death row viewed to be innocent. Only about 17 of them have been DNA cases, in fact. That's the kind of headline story, but it's not always the basis for, you know, false identification and innocence and so on. But that concern that maybe innocent people are ending up on death row and maybe being executed is one big part of public opinion change. The other reason for the change is that in a context where homicides are anyway way down compared to the 1990s, many people are looking at the state budgets and saying, look, can we afford to spend millions and sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars processing these capital punishment cases for 10, 15, 20 years, at the end of which nothing happens except the person's sentence is overturned and he goes to life imprisonment without parole? Why not save that money and just sentence people immediately to life imprisonment without parole for murder, rather than have this kind of charade of a death sentence that's never really carried out?
In fact, when you add that question about life in prison without parole, it seems that the opinion about the death penalty changes.
Well, that's exactly right. Most opinion polls about the death penalty are very superficial. They ask one question, do you support it or not for murder? People say yes. Typically, two-thirds of people say yes. But if you ask a little bit more of a searching question, do you support life in, the death penalty as compared to life imprisonment without parole, or life imprisonment without parole plus restitution to the victims' families, opinion changes, and people say, actually, you know, not the death penalty, I'd rather have one of these other measures. And you can understand why. The business of punishing a murderer is a very serious one. Most people want appropriate, severe punishment. On the other hand, life imprisonment without parole is very a severe punishment, and maybe can be instituted immediately. One of the things that one's seeing these days is this, that victims' families are actually ill-served by the death penalty, because even if a capital punishment is imposed, then the murderer and his death sentence will be litigated for decades to come. And every time that happens, the victims' families kind of dragged into it. Well, so we saw this with the Troy Davis case quite recently. And what's happening these days is prosecutors in places like Georgia and Texas are saying to victims' families, look, I can indict a death penalty charge and maybe persuade a jury to bring in capital punishment, but at the end of that trial, you'll face another decade or two of litigation. It would be an easy matter for me to get this person sentenced to life imprisonment without parole. Which would you prefer? And victims' families are increasingly prompting prosecutors to go for the latter option.
And we're almost out of time here. I mean, and I almost hate to say this, but it sounds like a pragmatic decision, which is that you might not get what it is that you want.
You know, the Constitution and the Supreme Court over the last 40 years have made it clear that if the death penalty is to be used in this country, it's to be used with so many safeguards, so much in the way of restriction and regulation, that in the end, it's not a routine, regular punishment that people can rely upon. Given that practical reality, the death penalty being kind of allergic to the rule of law, it gets more and more difficult for prosecutors and for juries and for victims to rely upon it.
Well, David Garland, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times, getting us started on this very important discussion. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
And he's a professor of law, professor of sociology at New York University, and he's the author of a book called Peculiar Institution, America's Death Penalty in an Age of Abolition. Stay with us. We're going to talk more with a second guest waiting in the wings. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY is provided by Interact Theater Company, currently opening its 24th season with Sarah Treem's new drama, The How and the Why. Inspired by the best-selling book, Woman, an Intimate Geography by Natalie Angier, The How and the Why pits two generations of evolutionary biologists against each other while both negotiate the fiercely male-dominated world of academic science. Evolution and emotion collide in this thought-provoking play about science, family, and the survival of the fittest. Tickets at interacttheater.org.
I'm Marty Moscowain. We hope to end the fall membership campaign tomorrow, and we can do it if you make a pledge of support to WHYY right now. The money gets invested in the programs you enjoy and tune to so you can stay informed. We don't call it public radio for nothing. You decide the value of Radio Times and all the programs here at WHYY and then make a pledge. Here's the phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Have you been feeling anxious, worried, on edge? The Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit at Penn Medicine is studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders. You may be eligible to participate in a research study looking at the effects of natural supplements to treat the symptoms of worry and anxiety. Initial evaluations determine eligibility for treatment. To learn more about Penn Medicine's Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit, 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Alan Alt wrote a moving personal essay about the death penalty in Newsweek that caught our eye. As commissioner of the Georgia Department of Corrections from 1992 to 1995, he oversaw five executions which continue to haunt him. He's currently the dean of the College of Justice and Safety at Eastern Kentucky University, and he joins us in the second portion of Radio Times. And Alan Alt, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thanks, Marty.
And I know that you've had several jobs in working in prisons. You were the commissioner of the Department of Corrections in the states of Georgia, Colorado, Mississippi, warden of a maximum security prison in Georgia. What was your interest in working in prisons?
Well, as soon as I got my doctorate in psychology, they hired me to develop the diagnostic and classification system for the state of Georgia, processed at that time about 7,000 a year. In order to do that, they made me the warden and superintendent at Jackson, Georgia, and that's where the executions for Troy Davis were carried out.
In fact, you had, I guess, overseen the renovation of a cell block at that prison.
Yes, to handle the 100 most violent offenders in the state. And then at that time, the death penalty had been outlawed by the U.S. Supreme Court. It wasn't until 76 that the first law, happened to be a Georgia law, was declared constitutional.
And you, as you wrote in this article, oversaw five executions. That was part of your job?
Yes. It had always been my philosophy that I wouldn't delegate to a staff something that I wouldn't do. And so I went to Jackson for those five executions, along with the Attorney General, and gave the orders for the execution.
Would it be fair to say you were a reluctant observer?
Yes. We stood behind, at that time it was an electric chair. There was a wall with a window in it, and the Attorney General had phones to the Supreme Court of both Georgia and the U.S. Supreme Court and the Governor's Office and Parole Office. And when all the stays had been completed, sometimes that was, there was an hour delay or sometimes a month delay. But when it was cleared, then we asked for if the inmate wanted the final words. And then when that was completed, then I'd give the order for the execution.
And you would give that order to the prison, what, electrician?
Electrician. In fact, he was the same electrician that was there when I was warden.
Oh, wow.
He saw it as, he never looked at the victim. He saw it as an electrical problem.
To carry out?
Yes.
How would you prepare for something like that? Prepare yourself.
It's very scripted. There's a policy and procedure book at that time, which is about an inch and a half thick, and it's rehearsed. It's the most premeditated murder possible. I mean, it's everything is down to minute details that you go through. And it was amazing that you did two or three practices. Now, in Texas, they don't have to practice because they execute so many. I mean, that's a true story. They told me they didn't practice anymore.
And what do you mean by practice?
You go run through the whole thing. You make sure that you didn't have an incident and like they had in Florida where the inmate's hair caught on fire and that sort of thing. There were several executions where the first jolt didn't kill the individual, and he had to be electrocuted three or four times before it took place. We didn't want any of that to happen. We didn't want a circus. It was a legal procedure, but we try to make it as dignified as we can, but that was pretty impossible.
And why are you haunted? I mean, I can hear this in your voice, but why are you haunted by this?
Well, I'm not a psychopath. I'm not a sadist. Hopefully, people consider me a person of conscience. And I think that's who should, if you have to do it, should carry it out. Somebody who values human life. And it always seemed to me so illogical that we want to teach society not to kill anybody by killing somebody. And all the research indicates it does not deter. The only thing I guess somebody said, well, it's not supposed to, it's punishment. Well, I noted that when people argue with me about this or discuss it, and they want to use Scripture, they always use Scripture from the Old Testament, never the New. And but it is also interesting that you talk to individuals and you give them the details, and we've done this in focus group, and their opinions are fairly reasonable after they get all the details. It's at first when asked, are you in favor of capital punishment, and they say yes. I think there's a lot of racial content to that. I agree with David on that.
The idea that it's punishing black people?
Yes, I think in Georgia, at the last time I was, when I was commissioner, early 90s, it was 75% black in the prison population. With the advent of meth, it's now about 50-50. But I think the death penalty is a racial fear stereotype. And I've talked to a lot of people on the street. I make a lot of speeches, and they get their feedback. And I assume that's not by research. That's anecdotal, but I really believe that.
When you say haunted, does that mean this would wake you up at night, or you would have? I mean, clearly you were doing something you didn't want to do.
Yes, I tried to bring. When I was a warden, I interviewed an inmate who admitted he was guilty. Very few do that, you know. But he said he robbed a country store, and he tied up a mom and pop. And he was driving down the road, and he thought how much he'd get for armed robbery. And then he thought if he got caught for murder, at that time they were paroling around 12 years. And so he went back and shot them. And I always use that in my mind. Well, that would have deterred him. But that was an inmate who used logic. And if he'd had some other ingredient in the equation, that it might have deterred him. But that was such a rare incident, and I don't. There's no evidence in any of the research that it deters.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to open up the lines as well. Alan Ault, the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. He's currently the dean of the College of Justice and Safety at Eastern Kentucky University, formerly the commissioner of the Department of Corrections in the states of Georgia, Colorado, and Mississippi, was a warden in a maximum security prison in Georgia. And in fact, it was an article that he wrote recently in Newsweek headlined, In My Nightmares, I Can See Their Faces Ordering Death in Georgia. And it's about his opposition to the use of the death penalty. We've got lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You write about two men in this article. You write about two men, Thomas Dean Stevens and Christopher Berger. They were found guilty of a horrible crime, as you wrote in this piece. You had no doubt that they had committed this crime, and yet you opposed the death penalty for them. How so?
They were 17 when they came to prison. They spent half their life. They were executed when they were 34. I mean, they truly were different people. And problem, they were people, and I got to know them. And if you don't have a conscience about killing somebody, then I don't think you ought to be in the business either. But that makes it very painful when you know them as human beings. And I was trained to kill people in the Army, but that was a different type of atmosphere. That was more self-defense. But this one became very personal because it's so premeditated. And carrying out the death penalty really, it's just not me, but I know several people who have done it who have the same sort of feelings.
Would you say that prison had rehabilitated them, or that they were now as men, that they were teenagers and now men?
Yes, they had developed frontal lobes with executive decision powers, which they didn't have probably at 16 or 17, and they were different. And they had been approached homosexually, and that's what started that whole horrific incident. So it was... And I know people say, well, the people they killed were human beings too. Yes, but that doesn't make it right that we continue to kill people.
Would it have been more appropriate for them to have life in prison, or do you think these were people that literally could have been rehabilitated and returned to society?
Well, many of the cases, I think probably, I mean, I met Mr. Manson out in California, and I would never want to let him out. I think there are certainly now very valid tests to indicate whether they're going to be violent recidivists, whether they're a psychopath or not. There's no known cure for a psychopath, and that constitutes about 15-20% of our prison population. And many of those I don't think should ever get out again. But I think a more appropriate punishment is serving a life sentence without parole for horrific crime.
Before, and as not to belabor this, but I think, and I ask this in part because this happens behind closed doors. The public doesn't see what you have seen and have ordered. But and you talk about the kind of scripted nature of executions. For these five executions that you oversaw, did you speak to these individuals before?
Yes.
Before their death?
There was a cell right by the execution chamber, and I always talked to them before. The chaplain usually was there, but I did talk to all of them before I executed them.
And what did they want to talk about?
A lot of it, I don't remember all the exact things, but many of them would ask for forgiveness or deny that they were guilty. Many of them denied they were guilty. And one of the inmates, in his final words, he didn't deny he was guilty. He just denied that they proved it in court. Mm. And that was his argument. He tried to filibuster, and I had to stop him and order the execution.
Is that common that people in prison or even people facing the death penalty deny that they have committed a crime?
Well, I think a lot of them rationalize what they did. I mean, just like you and I rationalize things that we did we're not exactly proud of, but they do try to rationalize what they did, many of them. And then there are many who do not have a conscience, and they don't try to rationalize it, and they don't feel guilt about it.
Do you think there are others like yourself who have overseen executions that in a sense suffer from what they have done and observed?
Yes. Don Cabana, who oversaw many executions at Parchment in Mississippi, has written on it, and he has still real problems with it. Morris Higpen, the director of the National Institute of Corrections, he executed some people when he's director in Alabama. And several others. There were six wardens, ex-wardens, that wrote a letter to the governor regarding Troy Davis, and many of them had participated in execution.
And what was your, and the Troy Davis case, of course, has been argued and litigated, but what was your reasoning for I guess, not having him be put to death?
Because there was doubt. I mean, not only were we against capital punishment, but when there's doubt, as David Garland pointed out, so many have been found innocent, have been on death row, that we would much rather err in caution about people. There's a lot of doubt about their guilt.
This feels like a ghoulish question, but because executions take place and we the public don't get to see them, do you think they should be televised so that we can see what happens when the death penalty is carried out?
I don't, in England they used to hang them in the public square or quarter them. I think one of my favorite true stories is that in England they were hanging pickpockets and they always drew a big crowd in the Times Square, and while they were hanging pickpockets, the pickpockets were out picking the pockets of the people observing the hanging. So again, it didn't serve a deterrent then and not now. I did know, I asked legislators several times to pass a lethal injection if they were going to continue the execution instead of the horrific execution by electric chair. And they wanted it. They told me they wanted it horrific, to set an example. Well, since that time, they have gone to lethal injections, as most states have.
Yeah. But you said an interesting thing, which is that you think that the people overseeing executions should be the people that, in a sense, are uncomfortable with a decision and maybe even opposed to it, because, in a sense, it humanizes it.
Yes.
If
we don't have some dignity and professionalism, and if we don't value human life, how do we expect others to do?
But you also say there's such a psychological toll for that, for people like yourself.
Yes, a lot of people have paid that toll. And I wouldn't exaggerate. I still see their faces in my nightmares, and I've had some traumatic incidences that brought it all back to me. And I don't dwell on it every day, or I don't mean to imply that, mm-hmm. but it's always with me.
And you work now at a university, and do you think that there are efforts, and I don't know whether, I don't want to overstate the Troy Davis case, but do you think people, and by that I mean the American public, are rethinking the death penalty? Or
well, several, I've appeared before several legislative groups that are rethinking it. And of course, I've spoken to Amnesty International at their annual conference. I've worked with the Association to Abolish the Death Penalty. Several groups are working in that arena. It was interesting that they used some of my interview tapes on MSNBC with one of the professors used it in a class to get discussion, and some of the students said, well, if you're not willing to kill people, you shouldn't get into corrections. Hmm. And I really got thinking about that. A lot of the kids coming to school now have already killed 4,000 or 5,000 people on video games. They've been killed themselves, and they just punch the reset button, and they're ready to go again. And it isn't very... It doesn't condition them for reality and what death is all about. I mean, it almost desensitizes them.
Do you regret having worked in prisons?
No. See, my background before I went in corrections work, I was in the Office of Rehabilitation, and that's always been my goal is to reduce recidivism. In other words, do whatever it takes to try to change people so they don't back and commit further crimes. And that was very interesting work. And for a psychologist, it's a very interesting line of work. And working with staff in some dangerous situations, I mean, you develop camaraderie that you can't get outside of wartime, I guess.
And we're almost at that time here, but do you think prisons can, not all of them, obviously, and not with everybody, but do you think prisons can rehabilitate people?
I can. In Canada, they use research and best practices. Unfortunately, only a few states do that here. Most of them are run by the politicians and who are catering to the worst base instincts of the voting public. And that adversely affects our ability to rehabilitate.
Well, Alan Ault, I know this is a difficult issue for you, and I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. And he's the dean of the College of Justice and Safety at Eastern Kentucky University. And we have a third guest waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Early breast cancer detection means better outcomes. The Women's Cancer Center at Fox Chase offers a full array of risk assessment and screening options, including genetic counseling. From October 20th through the 30th, the PA Breast Cancer Coalition's traveling photo exhibit, 67 Women, 67 Counties, Facing Breast Cancer in Pennsylvania, is on display for public viewing. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
I'm Marty Moscowane. We hope to end the fall membership campaign tomorrow, and we can do it if you make a pledge of support to WHYY right now. The money gets invested in the programs you enjoy and tune to so you can stay informed. We don't call it public radio for nothing. You decide the value of Radio Times and all the programs here at WHYY and then make a pledge. Here's the phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks.
Widener Law supports WHYY. For those thinking about law school and not sure what to expect, Widener Law is holding an information session October 29th at their Delaware campus from 9:45 a.m. to 1 p.m. Prospective students can attend a mock first-year class, meet current law students, and speak to faculty members. Again, this special information session is being held at Widener Law's Delaware campus, October 29th from 9:45 a.m. to 1 p.m. More information at law.widener.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, getting three perspectives on the criminal justice system. And joining us now is Matthew Mangino, former district attorney of Lawrence County, Pennsylvania. He now sits on the Pennsylvania Board of Probation and Parole. He blogs and writes articles, and one that interested us was about the growing number of people who literally are getting away with murder. And Matthew Mangino, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. I know you've been listening in with our other guests. Anything you want to say in response to what they said? And then I want to talk about some of the things that you've been writing about.
Well, I think, obviously, Professor Garland has done a great deal of work in this area. And I think his perspective is interesting because he really doesn't necessarily take a position on the death penalty, pro or anti-death penalty, but he really lays out a lot of information that I think is useful to get a better understanding of how this whole process works. And that's really what I wanted to do in terms of my recent column in the Philadelphia Inquirer, is just to provide some context to this whole debate.
In fact, you say, and I guess I'm probably stealing this from you, is that many people get away with murder in this country. In fact, most are not arrested. A killer is, as you wrote, 200 times more likely to get away with murder than to be executed for a murder.
Yeah. You know, we spend a lot of time in this country talking about, executions we spend an inordinate amount of time talking about some specific executions, but very few people face a death penalty in this country. An even smaller number are sentenced to death, and just a tiny fraction of those are executed. Since 1977, there have been 1,271 executions in this country. There have been 675,000 murders. Mm-hmm. And as you alluded to, you're 200 times more likely to get away with murder than to get executed for it. So what I wanted to do with this article is to give people, some context in terms of we spend so much time talking about issues that certainly are significant, but are we missing the big picture here? I mean, there are thousands of murderers, killers, walking among us on the streets, yet we focus so much time on this tiny fraction of people who are executed.
Well, let me go back, and I'm borrowing from your article. You say back in 1961, that is 50 years ago, 91% of murders or killings were cleared. What does that mean in law enforcement parlance?
What that means is that an arrest was made, that those homicides were solved. So, 45 years ago, we were solving 9 out of 10 homicides. In 2010, we're at about 64%. So we're literally down about 30% in terms of the number of homicides that we're clearing or solving in this country.
And that's, of course, a dramatic drop. What explains that, do you think?
Well, I think there are a lot of factors at work. Number one, it's not police work, because I think police work right now is as sophisticated as it's ever been. And we have tremendous training for police officers. We have very good technology that's used. We have DNA testing, which certainly wasn't available 45 years ago. So I don't think it's the quality of the police work. There are other factors at work. And number one is fear. I think people are afraid to get involved. You have an idea, a culture of no snitching, particularly in urban areas, where there's this pervasive culture. Don't cooperate with the police. If you've seen something, don't tell anybody about it. And that breeds fear within the community. You may be retaliated against. I think there's also the nature of homicide itself has changed. 45 years ago, a lot of homicide was between people who had some relationship or were familiar with one another or that were familiar within the community. Now, with
gangs and you know, fighting over drug turf and just the idea of pervasive drug use in a lot of areas, that familiarity is gone. And therefore, you might interact with somebody that you've never interacted with before, and all of a sudden, there's a homicide. You don't know who the person is. You don't, you know, that whole process has changed, and it's made it more difficult for police to investigate into solve crimes. Some people just don't want to get involved. You know, the process has become so cumbersome that someone sees an offense, no matter how violent it might be, and they're thinking to themselves, "Geez, I'm going to go to court 10 times. I'm working 2 jobs. How am I going to do this?" And so that whole mindset of cooperating and being involved in the criminal justice system has changed, and I think it just compounds the problems. You know, you solve less homicides, people lose confidence in the police, they're less trusting, and it just perpetuates itself. And I think that's what contributes to lower clearance rates in homicide cases.
And let me pick up on a couple of points that you just made there, because obviously it does raise questions about whether the system is too complicated, even too onerous for people who are either victims of crimes or want to participate, but they find, as you say, you get called into court, then they're, you know, you get off of work, and then the trial is postponed for the day. Do you think there's a way to make the system more friendly to victims of crime?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways that you can do this, I think in some ways the police are. Law enforcement is conscious of this. You have to build the trust in the community where people are confident that if they go to the police, that something's going to come of their cooperation, that they're going to be protected, that they don't have to fear retaliation. And then, you know, certainly, you know, the process has become cumbersome in terms of the proceedings, because we've built so many protections into the process for people who are accused of crime, and I don't think that that's a bad thing. I think that we need those protections, but those protections have made it more difficult. I think what would help would be to educate people more about the process who are involved in it. If you are a witness, make sure that they understand what the commitment is and what they have to do in order to provide the information that's needed for a particular prosecution. So I think there are things that you can do to help with that. But right now, you know, we're in a culture, I think, of fear, and one of, you know, it's just no use getting involved. And I think that's the wrong perception for people to have.
Scripps Howard did an investigation looking at exactly what we're talking about, looking at cities around the country, this no clearance rate in places like Chicago, 35%, New Orleans, 22%, Detroit, 21%. But they found in Philadelphia, back in 2006, the clearance rate was 56%. And now, a couple of years ago, it was 75%. The idea that smarter policing and working the job, as it's called, can deal with the problem that you've described. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I do agree with that. And Philadelphia certainly should be commended. I mean, going up 20% in their clearance rate in a couple of years is impressive, and I think has a lot to do with the leadership in terms of how you go about dealing with these issues. Even in Pennsylvania, generally, has a higher clearance rate than the rest of the country. I think Pennsylvania is at about 77% in terms of clearance rates across the state. So, you know, there's effective policing going on, you know, but I think that we can do better, and that we should do better. But in the context of this whole death penalty argument, I think this provides some context to what are we really focusing our attention on, and what should we be? I mean, would a citizen rather know who's getting executed and how they're getting executed and how that whole process is working, or knowing that last year there were 14,000 murders in the United States, and 5,000 of those murderers are still walking the street?
And that's Matthew Mangino, former district attorney. He's a member of the Pennsylvania Board of Probation and Parole. Our third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, and we are talking about our criminal justice system. We began by talking about the death penalty, but he wrote an article that we saw in the Philadelphia Inquirer recently, essentially saying that there are thousands of people in this country getting away with murder, and he wants to call attention to that. And we want to take some calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me see what Jean from Doylestown has to say. And Jean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I have a question that has to do with jury selection. When I went on, when I was called for jury, you know, not their jury duty, you signed a, you filled in a form that said your citizenship and this and that, and at the end it said, do you believe in the death penalty? And I was really taken aback and didn't know what to say because I don't believe in the death penalty, but I didn't want to be eliminated. So I'm curious, what is that all about, and why do they ask that?
Well, Jean, let me see if Matthew Mangino can answer your question. Matthew?
Well, I can. What happens is, in order to have a death penalty case, there's something that's called, when you voir dire the jury, when you go through that process, you have to disqualify that jury, which means, is that jury, are those jurors willing, if the law provides, to apply the death penalty? So, I mean, you can say, yeah, I don't believe in the death penalty. That could possibly eliminate you as a juror in a death penalty case. It wouldn't eliminate you in any other cases. But, you know, that process of selecting a jury provides that you, as a juror, would be willing to uphold the death penalty, to impose the death penalty, if you think the prosecution has proven that the death penalty is warranted. In fact, you could even be opposed to the death penalty, but agree that, yes, I'll apply it if the law says that I need to in that particular instance.
Well, Gene, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Going back to what we were talking about earlier, Matthew, but I we hear about police departments laying off police officers. Do you think that will affect the clearance rate as we've been talking about it?
Well sir, I think it has the potential to affect the crime rate in some ways. The clearance rate, I don't know that it's going to have that much of an impact, because you already have seasoned police officers who work in homicide units. Sometimes these are some of the finest detectives that a department has. They've been there for a while. So I don't know that layoffs would particularly impact the clearance rate of on homicides. I think it could have an impact on crime rates. And certainly over time, if you have tight budgets and you don't have the resources that you need to properly investigate cases, it could have an impact on clearance rates. But right now, I don't think that that is necessarily the case.
But what you are telling us is that there are people who have committed murder who are walking the streets.
Oh, there's no question, as I said. And there are a lot of them. Since the death penalty was instituted in 1977, there are about 230,000 unsolved homicides in this country. So there are a lot of people who've gotten away with murder who are walking the street. And when you compare that to 1,271 people who've been executed, you see the disparity there, and you know what deserves our attention.
And that's Matthew Mangino, as I said, former district attorney here in the state of Pennsylvania. He sits on the member of the, he is a member, I should say, of the Pennsylvania Board of Probation and Parole. And he also blogs and writes articles. And one that caught our eye has to do with the fact that there are people, as we were just talking, thousands of people in this country who are literally getting away with murder. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia.
And Ed Cunningham here with Debbie Builder, one of the producers of Radio Times. And Debbie, we're hearing yet one more example of why Philadelphia Magazine, no less, one of our longtime publications in the Delaware Valley, called Radio Times, quote, the best radio program in Philadelphia. And I think that's something perhaps we don't say enough and that we should celebrate more. And I can't think of a better way to do so than by supporting it. As simple as that. The way you do it is at 1-888-345-9499. 9499 before we do another thing. The number is 1-888-345-WHYY. The web address is WHYY.org. And Debbie, you should be proud of that fact, best radio program in Philadelphia. I mean, you do so much for the show, including working on this particular episode. Is that correct?
Yeah, this was really powerful radio. I mean, I'm thinking of Alan Alt talking about the psychological toll that the death penalty takes on people in the prison system, working in the prison system. These aren't stories you hear everywhere. These are stories you hear when you tune into Radio Times. Different perspectives on crime and punishment in the system. That's what this hour was about. Give us a call. Support Radio Times, what it does, 500 shows a year. That's,
wow.
Yeah, that's so many hours. The number to call and show your support is 1-888-345-9499. Become a member of WHYY and support Radio Times.
And the web address, too, WHYY.org. You know, we always say, Debbie, that you can't put a price tag on this kind of excellence, but I'm going to do it anyway because I've got here in my hand, actually not literally, but a little information on our WHYY eco-friendly grocery bag, which is available for a $75 pledge now at 1-888-345-9499. It says, think globally, listen locally, but the big story is, it's huge. It's canvas. It holds a bunch of your groceries. And since it is a canvas bag, you can save a lot of landfills by using this over and over and over again. So if you would like to have that, you can do so for a pledge of $75 at 1-888-345-9499 or WHYY.org. And for that matter, if you'd like to put it on a credit card, which I've been forgetting to tell people, and I should, it's a great deal, you can ask for 54 issues of Newsweek magazine for the next year simply for putting your pledge on a credit card. So do it right now. And Debbie, as I say, it has to be proud for you to be able to say, you know, I help produce 500 original hours of programming just on Radio Times every year.
Right, and this coming year is the 25th anniversary. Now, I haven't been with Radio Times for 25 years, but Marty has been doing amazing programs every weekday. And if you think of how many hours that is, that you've listened to something, heard something different, gotten deep analysis on an issue, whether it's an international issue or whether it's local news, culture, arts, and science, I think that is definitely worth a pledge of support. So give us a call.